coming up next on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. It's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio and the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. As always, we are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we are speaking with A.D. Carson, UVA professor of hip-hop and the Global South. He's a prolific writer, scholar, and award-winning artist. His dissertation is a 34-song rap album. And our first guest will be Matthew Reeves, director of archaeology at James Madison's Montpelier. We'll talk with him about excavation of slave sites at Montpelier and the new exhibit, A Mere Distinction of Color, and how working directly with descendants of slaves who toiled at the site has made his work and the exhibition possible. If you have questions and you're on Facebook, you can message us at Facebook at 947-WPVC, and we'll take your questions. Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. And I'd like to know, I've heard this intro, and sometimes I comment on it, I do admit, but you know, you could say I'm in our New York studios, and who's going to know?
Well, you are. I mean, aren't you?
Well, you always say I'm in New York.
I know.
I could be, you know, in all honesty, where I actually am. But I don't want to reveal that. You know, I think we should expand our locations. Let's just say I am in our New York studios.
And come by when
you're in New York. No, don't say that part.
No. Yeah. Well, I think I'll do that next time. No one will be any the wiser.
Add in two more syllables. I'm sure we can stay on track.
Yeah. I was going to, instead of Nancy, are you there, which I always say, I was going to say, I use they, because it's getting very mobby in here. Very, like, the mob, the Russian mobby. Mob.
It's nice to make it adorable. Yeah. It is. Like, it's. I got my Cabbage Patch toys, my kids, and my mobby kids, and... It definitely is.
You got some laundry machines for some laundering?
Yeah. Yes. Whirlpool, all of them. The mud rooms are really going to be the go-to room for new home buyers. Is there a mud room for all the...
I really brought you down. Money
washing we'll have to do for our dear leader or something to that effect.
There is a great Craig Unger piece in the New Republic all about... the money, the trillions of dollars that needed to be laundered from Russia, and how it's so tied to Trump, whether he knew it or not, his businesses enabled him to, through the money, enabled him to reinvent his image and so on. It's a great article, so I would check that out. And in the past 6 months...
I've been told his money has nothing to do with it, Ellen, and you should just butt out.
Right. I know. It is... Well, it's scary to talk about.
I believe that he told it twice, so it's got to be true.
It's slightly scary to talk about it because these are recorded forever, and you never know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Sorry to remind you. But 70%, did you know this? 70% of his sales in his buildings, Trump's, have gone to shell companies. So
yes.
we don't know where. We don't know the identity.
Yeah. He's a deal maker. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not that it's any of your business, but yeah, no, I get that. I guess the whole idea of the lazy days of summer are just something that we can tell our grandkids that we don't have about, because it doesn't feel at all like summer yet, and we're halfway through or so. I mean, he's just killing everything, that man and his entourage.
Well, luckily Spicy got wise and resigned.
Spicer. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I get it that he's gone, but he sure took enough, you know. So
I think the whole Pope thing, he was really pissed off about that. Couldn't see the Pope. But the new guy, Scaramucci, what a name, another loyalist of Trump. Surprise, he used to work at Goldman Sachs.
Right. And you know, does he not look a little like his son? You know, it's just,
no.
I mean, I'm sure he sees himself in this tough guy from Queens, as you said, at Goldman Sachs. Yeah, and it sounds like he's been all over the map. He's been very blue about issues, too. You know, not that they have that amnesia gene, so they'll forget all the. I believe he's pro gay marriage. I think he's. There's a few other very not Trump, you know, issues that he's been on the opposite side of, but I'm sure all of that is forgotten.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's a tough guy.
And.
Yeah,
I always like to reference back to the Macron handshake, or the handshakes. And there was the New York Times interview, which was very telling, really interesting. And of course, the Times is a failing newspaper, but he did a lengthy interview.
Yeah.
And
don't call it an interview. He
what was it? A ramble.
Vomited for 20 minutes. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's like a case study of like psychology when I'm reading it. I'm like, you know, the interpretation of his babble and what. Anyway,
right.
So he said. I think about Macron, he's going to be a terrific president of France, but he does love holding my hand.
I know. I saw that. I know. Yeah. And you saw the way he petted it as if we would acknowledge, oh, okay, Trump is dominant because he's patting Macron's hand. This must mean he's the vibrant hero we know he is to be, Trump, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's...
And then, well, no, never mind. Go on.
No.
Okay. Well, at the G20, the other little point I wanted to mention is that he was sitting next to the wife of Prime Minister of Japan, and he said, who I think is a terrific guy, and she's a terrific woman, but doesn't speak English. Meanwhile, she totally speaks English. She just chose not to talk to him.
That's
which
smart,
is a wise
smart move. Smart move.
Yeah. Anyway.
As much as we can't stand the guy, you know, I can't, what are we not hearing from the Globe, you know, about, oh my goodness, it's just, there's so many smart people in this country and none of them are in charge, you know?
Right.
It's just so irritating. It's just so frustrating. I wanted to share with you actually on Twitter yesterday in Virginia, there you have this golf course, which in Locust Village, just like 15 minutes from you. Anyway, apparently a very Trump part of town, part of the country rather, but they had, it was going around Twitter, a sign on their golf course that said, release Trump's golf scores.
And,
it was just a nice sign that.
That's good.
Some, you know, there's a bit of his base.
Oh, there's a base here, that's for sure. And something we can do about it is happening. Actually, is that today at 11, Nancy?
It is today from 11 to 12:30, yeah.
Okay, at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center here in Charlotte. Spread the Vote is an event to ensure that you are registered. It's a voter ID session, so...
Right, as they keep changing, or you get the sense that the government is changing what it means to be a registered voter, this is an event to get you up to speed on what Virginia, you know, Virginians have to do to be a registered voter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the most important things happening right now,
sure.
Is the effort to suppress
Agreed.
The vote and to fight that. So moving on with the show, we have another amazing show. Our first guest is Matthew Reeves, Director of Archaeology at James Madison's Montpelier. It's about 40 minutes from Charlottesville in Orange County. His research focus is on the archaeology of plantation life, African Americans, both enslaved and freed, and the Civil War. He's worked for over 17 years directing research projects on plantations and period sites in Jamaica, Maryland, and Virginia. Welcome, Matt.
Oh, thank you, Ellen. Great to be here.
Hey.
So I wanted to start with the new exhibit that began here in June at Montpelier called A Mere Distinction of Color. You've been excavating it for over 17 years. Tell us what you uncovered and how this exhibition came to be.
Yeah, it's the creation of the exhibit has been in the making for the past 2 years, but the research behind it and the involvement with the community has been a 17-year process. We, at Montpelier, what I'm in charge of as Director of Archaeology is trying to figure out what Montpelier looked like in the Madison's retirement era, which is the 1820s, 1830s. And what we've got at Montpelier is 2,700 acres, of which the core of it is the main plantation core from the Madison era, and it's incredibly well preserved. When Dolly sold the estate in the 1840s, at that point, the next owners, when they moved in, the slave quarters, the other outbuildings were in bad enough shape where they abandoned them or took them down. And these structures have been basically left, you know, their archaeological remains have been left untouched since that time. And so what we've been able to do through the archaeology is recover the remains of these buildings, you know, not just, you know, where the footprints of they are and what, how, you know, and from that figure out what they looked like, but also from the artifacts understand how they were used. So what we've been building is this understanding of what the Madison Plantation looked like. And we're a little bit of a loss at Montpelier because most of the documents that relate to this period, to the retirement years, the 1810s, 1820s, 1830s, these were all burned by John Payne Todd, by Madison's stepson, John Payne Todd. They were burned in the 1850s. So with that went lists of slaves, the description of buildings, maps, all that's gone. So we're recovering this with the archaeology. And in the process of doing this archaeology, what we've had a focus on is African Americans, the African American community. Because when you look at, you know, who was at Montpelier, say in 1820, 90 to 95% of the people at Montpelier were African American, were enslaved. And so when you're digging in the ground, almost any artifact you find, the last person to have touched that was a member of the enslaved community. And at the same time this was going on, when I started at Montpelier, one of the first people I met in the community was a wonderful lady, Rebecca Gilmore Coleman, who's a descendant of one of the slaves at Montpelier, George Gilmore. And he and his wife in the 1870s built a cabin that is on the Montpelier's land called the Gilmore Cabin. And early on we restored that. It was one of the first buildings we restored on the property, even before the main house. And so we began telling this story in an authentic way of, you know, Madison's legacy of what happened after emancipation, not Madison's freeing his slaves because he freed none of his slaves. This is after the Civil War. And what this got us to was, and this is all leading up to the exhibit, is what this got us to was, you know, what Madison's legacy was, is what he was best known for. You know, he was the fourth president of the United States, but he's known as the father of the Constitution. And what's the most relevant part of the Constitution, but developing, you know, what, how the U.S., how U.S. citizens can conceptualize citizenship, you know, self-government. But when you look at what Madison and the Founding Fathers were doing when they established the U.S. and gave, you know, provided citizenship, it was for a very small portion of the population. You had to be white, you had to be male, and you had to be a person of means, allowing you to be educated. And so you're talking, you know, maybe 15-20% of the population. And when you looked at Montpelier at that time, of the 130 people that were at Montpelier, two or three would have been considered citizens. So, you know, when you start looking at, you know, Madison, you know, he's the founder of the Constitution, developed, you know, what we see as American citizenship, isn't it ironic, or isn't it a paradox that he was a slave owner? It's like, well, no, you know, back in the 1820s, 18-teens, who was considered a citizen was a very limited frame of folks. And that was, you know, literally owned by the Founding Fathers. They literally owned people that were not citizens. So in many ways, what we started to see, what the paradox was, is not Madison. It wasn't with Madison's history. It was with us presenting the Madison history without presenting the enslaved community as an integral part of that. And so what we've developed over the years is Rebecca Gilmore Coleman founded the Orange County African American Historical Society, and through working with her, we've brought in the community into the various restoration projects we've done, openings of the restored train station, which is a Jim Crow era train station with a separate colored and white entrance. The impetus to restore that to its Jim Crow appearance, and not just as a train station, came from the local community saying, you know, we have no place to bring our children where we can talk about the era of Jim Crow. Having that train station restored and telling the whole truth, not whitewashing it. In that case, it would literally be whitewashing it by taking down those signs, but telling the whole truth, allowing folks to go in there and judge for themselves. That really became part of the core of our culture as an institution. And so in many ways, what we really fell behind with in terms of not being established, you know, like in the 1920s when we could have gotten all the furniture of the Madisons and had, you know, all the oral histories. We actually came ahead because we didn't have that institutional history of, you know, putting our guy on a pedestal. I mean, we still honor Mr. Madison. I mean, he was, you know, we feel he's one of the greatest founding fathers of all of them because that, we're in Montpelier and, you know, we know what he did. But also what makes his contributions and the contributions of the people at Montpelier, the African-Americans, everyone great is just telling that whole truth, telling all the information that what happened, and really putting Madison's contributions into the context of what was happening at the time. So it's been this slow process of building information, building constituencies, and when we got the opportunity to restore the slave quarters at Montpelier, we discovered them archaeologically. David Rubenstein, who is a patriotic philanthropist, he gave us $10 million about 2 years ago to restore the slave quarters, create an exhibit talking about slavery and the Constitution, and help refurnish the house. We were at a perfect junction with our understanding of Montpelier's history, our work with the descendant and the local community, to really build something that put this all into context. Because one thing we didn't want to do with that money is restore the slave quarters and have people see the slave quarters absent of the political and historical context of the time. And say, for example, walk into a slave quarter, be a 15 by 15 structure with a, you know, a decent looking bed and some ceramics on a cupboard, and say, oh, slavery wasn't that bad. You know, this is, I could live here. Well, it's not the point, you know, whether or not, you know, it is, but it isn't for the big picture, whether, you know, Madison whipped his slaves or he had them in nice houses. The real relevant point is they were slaves, they were property. And at any time, especially with him being in debt and when he passed away, they were sold, and they weren't sold as people, they were sold as commodities. And that made it so that, you know, families are divided. I mean, that today, I think we can all see, would be our worst nightmare. And so what we're doing in this exhibit is trying to present the whole picture of what happened at Montpelier, the whole picture of what the Constitution was doing as a political document, which was really protecting the institution that was America. I mean, Madison was so, he was, you know, obsessed, like many of the founding fathers were, with making sure that the union of the state survived. And to protect that union, you know, we were set at that time in the late 18th, early 19th century, in a really dangerous time with European powers and how they were trying to control things. But as a unified mass, we were able to create a country that could ward off, you know, advances from England and France. But what the base for that was the economy, like any political structure is, and the need to protect that economy. And of course, you know where I'm going with this, the economy was based on slavery. In the 1820s, 80% of the GDP, the gross domestic product, was off, you know, based on the labor of slaves, the value of slaves. And making sure that institution was protected meant that the union of states was protected, which in the end was Madison's goal. So putting, you know, slavery in the context of how the Constitution in many ways defended slavery, putting slavery in the context of what it meant to be a slave in terms of not just being exposed to abuse, but not having no, you know, security, no outlook in terms of where you would be, you know, because you're property. So
we're talking to Matthew Reeves, Director of Archaeology at James Madison's Montpelier. We have about 10 seconds. We're going to go to a hard break, and we will come right back. We'll continue talking to Matthew Reeves, and then a little bit later, we'll talk to A.D. Carson, the professor of hip-hop at UVA and global racism. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and you're listening to Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Matthew Reeves, Director of Archaeology at James Madison's Montpelier. A little later, we'll talk to A.D. Carson.
Hey, Matt, I was just wondering, with this obvious concerted effort to present the entire history of America at that time, how did Montpelier get recognized in the black community as this legitimate home space for addressing all the issues? How'd you do that?
Oh, well, thanks, Nancy. Part of it was really serendipity of having the Montpelier Foundation be created at the same time that the Orange County African American Historical Society began. And another part of it was, in many ways, some of the programs, the public programs that we do. In for the archaeology department, what we've tried to do over the past decade is find ways to include the public in our excavations and research process in many ways as possible. So we do these, what we call expedition programs. They're these one-week programs where people come out for a week, live on the property, work side-by-side with our staff, doing archaeology, making discoveries. And what we were able to do through networking with the local community is get African Americans involved in this process. And what we discovered and what the community discovered is just, you know, how powerful it was to have, you know, folks whose ancestry was, you know, either directly or indirectly related to the families at Montpelier to come on a site, come on a slave on a slave quarter, do excavations, find a ceramic sherd, and to realize that the last person that touched that sherd was either one of your ancestors or someone that was in close contact with your ancestors. And for African Americans, I mean, it's for the period of slavery, there's very few connections that are tangible that you can make to that period, because as, you know, considered property. So, for example, the slaves at Montpelier, when Dolly Madison sold them in 1844, they were sold from the steps of Montpelier. Some stayed in the area, but most were sold through Richmond and then ended up in other parts of the South, especially the Deep South. And so when you're sold as a piece of property, you're not going to be, you know, interested in saving your grandmother's ceramic. You're going to be where your heart is going to be is your family being divided. So to actually be able to, as a descendant, touch a piece of your ancestor's, you know, prized belongings, to find a marble in the ground, like a friend of mine, Leontini, recently found, and, you know, to realize that, you know, she's got a tangible connection with her ancestors. It created this incredible connection where all of a sudden we, as an institution, we're able to offer something to African Americans that they could not get anywhere else, this connection with the past. And through that process, many folks get involved with not only the research, but also our interpretation and looking at how we're presenting this past. And we involved the descendant and the local community in discussions of how to set up the exhibits, what areas to restore. And that was before we get the gift from Mr. Rubenstein. So when we get the gift from Mr. Rubenstein to restore the slave quarters, we were in this great position to actively involve the descendant and the local community in the trajectory of where we went with a set of resources where we could make a difference. So, you know, 5 years ago, producing the exhibit that we created, The Mere Distinction of Color, that sets the context for the restored spaces at Montpelier, both, you know, enslaved and Madison, would not have been possible without those resources. So it's all come together to make for really an amazing experience for everyone involved and make Montpelier more of a home place.
And I will say it is amazing. It's multimedia. It's really interesting. When you talk about seeing things, actual artifacts, there's something on display that's it looks like a quartz crystal, a pink one. And I'm a fan of precious gems and healing properties like that. And it was amazing to see that. It's a really big chunk of beautifully etched out quartz, and it's on display. And so the exhibit is extremely well done, very moving.
And that quartz, we actually didn't realize the significance of that quartz until we were, during one of the participant excavations that involved some of the descendants, we talked about finding that quartz in one of the piers for the slave quarters, and many folks said, you know, our grandmothers, our, you know, older folk would always put, you know, a white object in the corner of the room. That is of significance. So what we decided when we were rebuilding that quarter later on that year, was the masons built the pier, we placed another quartz crystal, not the one that was found, but one that was very similar, you know, a natural quartz crystal. We had descendants come back, and we did a ceremony where we placed that in the corner, the pier of that foundation, to recapture, you know, that essence, that spiritual belief of protection for the home. And little acts like this, you know, what it's done is we've been able to make Montpelier a place that's more inclusive, you know, not only in the stories, but also as a place where, you know, there's a we have a much larger community today because of this. And one thing I'm really proud of is the excavation programs we've done, being inclusive, being ones where not only can anyone come out, you know, you can come out and dig for a week and spend the week, and those are fee based, but those support these programs towards looking at truth and reconciliation that we're trying to do. And a big thing that that has come from this is we as an institution, as a discipline of historical archaeology, what we are is a very white discipline, and what we're trying to use these programs to do is to get African Americans more involved in, you know, with our mentoring, with interns, and getting more of the community involved, as you know, in the profession. And so there's a lot of outcomes. We could go in many different directions. I'm kind of going in different tangents here. Sorry, Nancy.
No, it's okay. I was wondering if you could describe a little bit more about these excavation programs. I know that's, you know, the slave quarters is a new aspect of it. I was just wondering what's, you know, who's involved from your side, and who are you hoping will participate?
They're open to everyone. I mean, the what we call these is citizen science, where we get the public involved in a deep dive and working, you know, in the doing the excavations, helping with the analysis. With the 2,700 acres, we have metal detector programs where metal detectorists come out for a week and learn how to do gridded metal detector survey. And one of the things we've done is with the programs is we offer scholarships for African Americans to come on these programs. And in that way, when we first started inviting African Americans, the local community, to come out, we didn't get much response. And finally, a friend of mine just took me aside and said, "Matt, you know, you talk about saying come out and dig for free at Montpelier, and all I can say is we tried that 200 years ago and it didn't work out that well for us." And I was like, "Oh my goodness, touche!" You know, so it's presenting in a way that recognizing that we've got a history as an institution, and we need to change the narrative, change how we tell that story. And I think in the end, by making it a broader story and more inclusive, it's not just African Americans we're going to bring into this history, it's all people, and make this history and the broader, you know, understanding of where we've been as a country available to a much, you know, much broader audience. So we're not just checking off a box when we're involving African Americans. It's a way to, you know, make this a more powerful and more meaningful story for all people.
How much of the grounds are intact, you know, for the purpose of excavating?
Still gives me chills. The property was owned by the DuPont family from 1901 to 1984, and all during the 20th century, when it could have been plowed, the DuPonts, with their wealth, they didn't need to make a couple hundred dollars off a field or cutting trees. So pretty much all 2,700 acres have been untouched either since the Civil War or since when Dolly sold the land. If I had known what kind of sites were at Montpelier when I interviewed in May of 2000, I probably would have just totally blown the interview. So it's been a gradual process of discovery, and not only the richness of the land, what we can do with this information to tell this broader, you know, story, and really make Montpelier a more authentic place, not only in terms of, you know, bringing it back to how it looked in Madison's day, but really tell a story that is authentic to what the character of Montpelier was, and also try to get to more an authentic story of who we are as a nation and where we come from. You know, what is behind the various amendments to the Constitution? Why is it the Second Amendment, you know, the right to bear arms, which is important for us today? What did it mean then? I mean, which was creating militias. And what were militias for in the South? Well, the biggest threat for the institutions of power at that time were slaves. So militias were intended to protect owners from uprisings of slaves, and slaves knowing militias were there, it was difficult to revolt. So it's that little bits of history like that. These tenets of what we consider America have changed through time, and without knowing the DNA of who we are as a nation and our history, we're not going to know who we are today and why, you know, different groups, you know, react viscerally. I mean, we've got a long history, and understand who we are and what issues we have today. It's like knowing your medical history. We got to know our political and social history.
So, what would you want people to take away from your work?
First thing is let people know they can come out and dig at Montpelier.
All right.
I find it's the biggest secret we've got at Montpelier. First, you can visit Montpelier. We're open 7 days a week. You can visit the property for free, walk the trails, but also you can spend a week at Montpelier if you go to www.montpelier.org/dig or email us at dig@montpelier.org. Just like it sounds, dig@montpelier.org. We can send you more information on the programs and also send you any information you want on visiting Montpelier.
And we'll also link those on our website, the station website, 947wpvc.org, where all of our shows are there for the listening. So I want to thank you so much for being here. Matthew Reeves,
yeah.
Director of Archaeology at James Madison's Montpelier. Thank you so, so much.
Thanks,
yeah,
Ellen.
Great
and Nancy.
To meet you.
It was a pleasure.
Yep. All right. So in news of note from me, comes in the form of aiding and abetting. I have a theme. I have two. The government has shut down the war crimes office at the State Department, so I guess Geneva Conventions will now just be a suggestion, not that we'll know about it. And Tillerson also is considering closing the State Department's entire cyber office. Tone deaf to the world, limiting the people who work on cybersecurity, as well as he let go our top cyber diplomat, so we're no longer really involved in discussions around the world about critical infrastructure and our security. It's all just flying by the seat of nothing. Anyway, what do you got?
Well, Mueller cannot work fast enough as far as I'm concerned. I mean, get this thing going. I mean, I know it's going, but you know, when you read these things, it's like, get them out now. You know, it's like a panic that I have. Well, I don't have much more. I just wanted to reiterate that at 11 o'clock, you can go make sure you vote, make sure you're registered. A lot of people are being purged from the rolls around the country. There's a concerted effort to do that, contrary to what the administration may say about voter fraud. It's really voter suppression that is going on. And so at 11 o'clock, the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center, you can go there and see about your right to vote. Let's make sure you're on the rolls.
Just a footnote on that, the GOP, you know, the Republicans are trying to close down the FEC commission that exists to ensure voter protection. So you are completely, if they do that, you know, you're completely on your own to make sure your vote counts. I mean, there's no one to watch your back.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
All right. Well, thanks, Nance. Well, our next guest, so excited to introduce, is A.D. Carson. He's a University of Virginia professor of hip-hop and the Global South. I said global something else. It's really the Global South, and we'll learn about what that is. He's a prolific writer, scholar, and award-winning artist. His dissertation is a 34-song rap album called Owning My Masters, The Rhetorics of Rhymes and Revolutions. It uses hip-hop to explore identity, global racial and class hierarchies, economics, and so much more. He received his doctorate at Clemson University. Welcome, A.D.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yes.
So maybe the obvious question for me is, why did you decide to wrap your dissertation instead of writing about your topic the more traditional way? And what are you trying to say?
Well, I think that the wrapping of the dissertation came from really just being in the place where the work was going on. And it just seemed really necessary for me to take the stance of presenting the work in a way that I felt it would be just better representative of what I was trying to describe, the circumstance that I was trying to describe when we talk about black bodies and black voices existing in academic institutions, not just Clemson, but across the board.
Well,
was your idea to always make this Owning My Masters, a 34-track piece, your dissertation, or did it evolve into your dissertation?
Yeah, when I write just about every day, and sometimes, some days, I write raps. And when I was there, you know, like the day that I arrived or the week that I arrived was also the week that Trayvon Martin's killer was found not guilty. And so my response to that was to write about it. And then I think within the next week, you know, there are a couple of films that came out, like 12 Years a Slave, Fruitvale Station. So I'm and then I'm also reading and engaging with the histories of rhetorics. And as that's happening, then, of course, like the writing, the poetry and the rap music that I'm writing, along with the other things that I'm writing for class, like have all of these things sort of coming together. And then, you know, when I get to the end of that semester, I have a collection of things which ultimately become the first semester mixtape, which I titled Term One. And, you know, being asked to present something on the histories of rhetorics, then I thought, well, I have a history here that started with that particular, you know, the incident that I mentioned previously, and ends with my being asked to present a project that is going to represent a history among the histories of rhetorics. And so then when that happened and I had that conversation with my program director, the professor, I thought, yeah, this is maybe a way that I can do the finishing project, because it seems to be something that hadn't been done before and was necessary.
We're coming up to a break. We're going to continue talking with A.D. Carson, the UVA professor of hip-hop and the Global South. We will be right back. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We are speaking with A.D. Carson, the UVA professor of hip-hop and the Global South.
A.D., I know before we cut out for a break, you were just, you know, getting into the inspiration for your dissertation. I don't want to lose sight of that. So what issues, as a student at Clemson, what issues was your dissertation addressing?
Well, there are a lot of things that were going on campus. I mean, you know, like one of the most obvious things is that, you know, like the huge building that is associated most commonly with the university is named for Benjamin Tillman. You could do a quick Google search of Benjamin Tillman and then see how it might be disturbing to be a student at Clemson and then, you know, think about being a student of color there and about the kinds of things that he said and did to people of the black community. The ways that we come to know him and engage him as a historical figure. And then you think about the sort of the contemporary iterations of that kind of thought and what, like how students might get along in the present, and then how people might feel. And so, I mean, I was just kind of thinking every Friday we have this thing where everybody wears orange shirts. You know, I go and I visit because there's also a plantation house in the middle of the campus that's open 7 days a week. And you go down the hill from the plantation house. That's the football field. We've got, you know, an up and coming football team, you know, which ultimately becomes the number one team in the country. But on that field, you know, like while this labor is going on with the so-called amateur athletes, you know, like. And they call this the most exciting 25 seconds in college football. At the apex of that hill is, you know, like a plantation house. And so I just wonder, why is this not a thing that we talk about when we, like, we're cutting on ESPN to this building, this name for this reprehensible guy. And we're showing the football players running down this hill, but we're not showing what's at the top of the hill. You know, like rather than whitewashing, you know, like I call it this an orange washing. And then thought, well, maybe we should, if we're going to be called the Clemson Tigers, maybe we should see the stripes in that mascot. And so then that led me to writing something using that metaphor to be able to talk about that history. And so that's like just one of the things. That's just, I don't know if it's like track number 4 or 5.
Well, it's on C's, let's see, C Stripes, CU for ClemsonU.org. And it's a really good 6-minute piece exactly about that. It really is pretty powerful.
I appreciate
about,
that.
Yeah, it's about the contradiction that you talk about. I would recommend listening to it. And also, I'd say, while mentioning websites, PhD. So the website where you can hear the 34 track dissertation is phd.adthegreat.com, and AD is spelled out. But we'll list that on our website as well.
Okay, AD, your choice of of using so many layers of tracks from other artists and other writers, singers. I know they're all artists. How did you arrive at presenting history that way, layering it all in the ways that you did?
Well, I think that, you know, I guess the easiest way to talk about it is to use, you know, like one of the ways that I thought about this was like reading Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. And you think about that, you know, the character from the story going into this underground space that has the 1,369 lights and, you know, and he's wanting to listen to multiple phonographs at different times. And so I imagine that space being a space that I was in there at Clemson, but just a space that I'm in the world. And then thinking about all of those voices, rather than them being Louis Armstrong singing "What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue," they are presenting these particular moments in history and in the present that I'm sort of able to reach out and grab and speak to. And so I'm kind of engaging with the world, or I'm engaging with media in ways that I imagine myself being the invisible man in that underground space. And so I imagine that underground space like a, you know, like a rap cipher, and the productive thing that comes from it may be one of these, you know, these things that becomes, you know, one of the 34 tracks on the album.
Did you write anything with paper and pen, or is it all in the studio when you worked on this?
Do you mean like did I write it down before I recorded it, or did I write things that were like along with the dissertation?
No, the first one. As you made this piece, this your dissertation, do you even think that way with pen and paper, or is it always right in the studio hearing stuff?
Oh no, I'm always writing. I'm writing right here, right now. I mean, I have Evernote open. Yeah. I mean, I got something, you know, because I'm always ready. That's how that's how it goes down. Yeah, of course. All right, cool. Let's see. I'm from where the murder rate is disturbing, but no curb in the crime. Time and time again, you find the swine has a purpose, but trying to protect and serve ain't the one you hear him doing. Hit a pistol fire, and it's likely them to shooting. Ain't no police in the police, but at least we all know it. And ain't no dreaming in these streets about being a poet. We owe it all to public schools, where the rules is to show it that you know the answers to the test, but unless it's an oval that you filling in, then the feeling is like swimming and drowning. And black is black. We don't distinguish from cinnamon brown and mahogany onyx and all of its chronic. So we swallow in tonic and wallow in all in it. See, I find it ironic that this is iconic. It's marketed, so you want it, and I sell it with promise. And I can guarantee he's got a bullet and a badge and took an oath to protect and to serve, but just to look, and he's scared of me. And I'm aware that he is, but I wonder, are you? And ain't no asking you to freeze for the open and shoot. I know you think he got degrees, but I'm hopeless as you. A nigga with the PhD, still a nigga when blue lights flash and I match the description. Ain't no explaining that. Ain't no amount of philosophy spit negating that. Can't quote a book and then hope you out if he's got a badge and he believes that he can choke you out. Hands up, stand up, and they shooting you down. So keep your eyes to the mirror when you cruise through the town. I'm from where the boys in blue don't play. Cough up along where I'm from, USA. Ain't nothing nice. No, that's, you know, that's part of, you know, this.
I'm starting to feel guilty for keeping you here when you could be continuing, which I do already. I do feel guilty. We're keeping you from writing something, but that is amazing. And I'm just wondering, I know you haven't started teaching yet, but I guess I'm concerned for you. Will you be able to be this person as a teacher, as a professor?
Yeah, I will. I mean, I've been able to make it this far. I'll be good.
Yeah,
you know, I had the torch thing. That was 2 days before I moved here. So, yeah, I'm still writing about it. But, I mean, and so I have another project, you know, that'll be coming soon after the semester starts. But, yeah, I mean, I imagine that, you know, like, as I was coming to, you know, speak back and forth with the folks here at UVA, We've had conversations. I believe that they know my work. I believe they appreciate what it is that I'm doing, and I'm up for the challenge of being myself in this place. But even if I wasn't up for the challenge, it's something that I'm going to have to deal with. And if it's not Charlottesville, then it's another city across this country or in some other space that I'm going to have to engage with. So there's no. What is it? The poem says, running from it will not save you.
Thank you for putting me in my place. Well said. How do you see your role as a teacher, even though I know you have a few weeks to go, but how do you see your role?
Well, I think that the role is I'm here to learn as much as I am to teach. I want to know what's going on here, but I also want to try to be to try to be an advocate, an ally, someone that folks in the community, folks at the university can speak to. But like, I want to also try to, you know, empower folks to speak up, speak out, or if I have the ability to help to amplify, then those are the things that I'm thinking about doing. And then ways that we might, as these histories get told and as these, responses to the, to the present moment unfold, like to really think about ways that we can, that we can speak to them. And so like what I'm doing is just one of many ways that we might speak to the present
Central
moment.
Virginia's progressive voice.
Did you know that people spend more time finding... Are we still here?
Yeah.
Dennis, so. How's it going on the board there? He's doing a great job. That was just a little technical issue.
Oh, word.
Continue.
I was just thinking about ways that, in the classroom, to think about how we might respond, like I said, to the current moment, to the present, but then like ways that we might also tell those histories, and make those things visible, I think is really important.
Do you see yourself as an advocate for hip hop in Charlottesville proper? Are you, is that also something that you have your eyes on, set your eyes on?
Well, yeah, I don't know if advocate is the right word. I know that I want to be responsive to the hip hop community that exists here, and I want to be supportive, and, I'm still learning the lay of the land. And so, I got to get out to more shows, listen to more folks. There was, I'm reading and meeting people, reading things and meeting people. And, hopefully there are opportunities to collaborate and to support. And I believe that those will happen. The folks that I have met so far have been very welcoming, and hopefully that continues to happen so I can find some space to be able to interact with the hip hop community this year.
So in the couple minutes that we have left, what do you mean by the Global South? So that's another one of your focuses, foci.
I think the Global South is a part of an initiative that UVA is doing. And so as my work like really focuses, or at least this particular project focuses on the American South, but not just the American South, but because it's created in the American South. And then we're here at the University of Virginia. I believe that those are reasons why my project and my work might have appealed to the people in the music department here at UVA. So that's like, at least that's my response to what I think they were thinking of with the Global South in my work. But again, I'm not so certain about like all of the other definitions of the Global South that may exist out there. And so I don't want to say something and then, it not be what I actually feel or think, or what is not actually going to be happening in my job.
Mm-hmm. When you're writing something that's not a hip hop lyric, when it's an art, you've written award-winning articles and essays and papers and magazines, et cetera, is your approach to writing that kind of writing different from a hip hop lyric in your, in your creative process?
No. I mean, I think that when I sit down to write, I don't have the idea of what the end piece is going to be. And sometimes I sit down to write a rap and then it becomes a story or it becomes an essay. And sometimes I sit down to write an essay and it becomes a song. And I just kind of roll with that because I'm not necessarily interested in trying to dictate what the piece is going to be whenever I start writing it. I think it's frustrating sometimes if I do sit down and I have a deadline and there's this particular thing that has to be done, and then I get sort of taken off the creative process, takes me to another space. But at the end of it, I'm glad to have that particular product finished. So I just kind of go with whatever with whatever the world is giving me, and wherever my creativity takes me. I'm cool with ending up there. It just, like I said, gets a little frustrating if there are deadlines.
Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by certain voices are treated differently I think that might have been like a main topic that you addressed.
Yeah, I think is you know, it's fairly apparent that, you know, in certain spaces that certain voices are treated differently. And so, I mean, even asking that question, I don't know if that's like even the point. Like, I think that we would all agree that certain voices are treated differently. But what I'm interested in is how those voices are treated, you know, and then how those voices and the connections to those bodies, you know, like have manifestations in the real world. Like, what does it mean? You know, what does it mean to say to a police officer, I can't breathe? Mm-hmm. You know, what is the response to that? Like, am I not human? Does that not resonate with you as a human being whenever I tell you that? So a version of that would be, you know, the rapping voice at the academic institution offering a response to the questions that we all might be dealing with. And then the way that an audience might want to engage that voice as the means by which we are responding to that particular question or that particular topic or issue.
Like you say in the See the Stripes, I just really like one of the lines. Since we gain so much from what we see, we smile, proud of the great tradition of which we have the benefit of saying we are now a part. And that really pertains to UVA and also everywhere,
yeah.
I think. So I think we have time for one more, Nance.
I've already stepped on your line, Alan.
No, it's okay.
I'll get this
in. You can't see me, so, you know.
Just about your dissertation, AD, I was just curious, in what ways, because people will be listening to it that are listening now, how do you want people to participate in that listening? What is your goal there?
Well, I think there are a lot of different ways that people can listen. I mean, you know, Twitter is always jumping off in various interesting ways. But, you know, you could also go to, like, there's a link to the lyrics on the dissertation site, and you can go there. You can annotate lyrics. You can ask questions about the lyrics. But I think, you know, I mean, I want people to participate. I want people to listen and also understand that, you know, listening one time is probably not the way that you're going to understand everything that went on. This is a project that I've been writing for the past 3.5 years. Mm. So, you know, it's multiple listens, but then, you know, going into those spaces where you actually can ask questions and annotate and research, you know, Google is still a thing that people can use.
Right. And that website again is phd.adthegreat.com. Thank you so much for being here, AD Carson. Professor of hip-hop in the Global South, prolific writer, scholar, award-winning artist. Thank you so much. And Matthew Reeves, Director of Archaeology at James Madison's Montpelier. Everyone, go out and see that exhibit. It's really great, called The Mere Color of Distinction. Thank you both so much for being here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And this will be on the website along with all of our other shows. You can go to 947wpvc.org and find all our shows. We've done 20 shows, Nance.
I know.
It's amazing.
I know. How old are we? I know.
It is. Great. So it's been great. I hear some music, but do you have any parting words?
Can I get a palate cleanser in, or do you try to
really
wrap up?
Yeah. If you can do it
yes?
in 10. No. Yeah, 10 seconds. Go.
Okay. There is a dahlia plant in the world called not cerise and saffron, but is humbly called the ketchup and mustard dahlia. It's a legit flower, and I just couldn't get over it. It didn't get Latinized or made obtuse.
All right,
so
it's 11.
There's a ketchup and mustard.
Thanks for that. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you. Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. We'll see you next week. Bye, Nance.
Bye, Ellen.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Showing host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.